all of us agree that the gravest domestic threat facing our nation today is drugs.
When President George H.W. Bush delivered this special Oval Office address on September 5th, 1989, the United States was already nearly two decades into the war on drugs. In 1971, President Richard Nixon called drug abuse public enemy number one. His administration launched broad federal policy that proposed mandatory prison sentences and expanded federal drug control agencies. In his 1989 address, Bush told the American people it was time to double down.
Well, here the rules have changed. If you sell drugs, you will be caught. And when you're caught, you will be prosecuted. And once you're convicted, you will do time. Caught, prosecuted, punished. I'm also proposing that we enlarge our criminal justice system across the board, at the local, state, and federal levels alike. We need more prisons, more jails, more courts, more prosecutors.
Well, on that night in 1989, Democrats offered their rebuttal. Not a rebuttal, really, because there was bipartisan agreement to go hard in the war on drugs. Democrats at the time said Bush's caught, prosecuted, and punished plan didn't go far enough. And their response was delivered by the senator from Delaware, Joe Biden.
We don't oppose the president's plan. All we want to do is strengthen it. We don't doubt his resolve. All we want to do is stiffen it. The trouble is that the president's proposals are not big enough to deal with the problem.
Well, 31 years later, how things change. Last month, in the second presidential debate, Biden offered an entirely different view on drugs in the United States.
There should be no minimum mandatories in the law. That's why I'm offering $20 billion to states to change their state laws to eliminate minimum mandatories and set up drug courts. No one should be going to jail because they have a drug problem. They should be going to rehabilitation, not to jail. We should fundamentally change the system, and that's what I'm going to do.
Biden has taken heavy criticism for being a key part of the system he now says needs changing. Truth is, he's not alone in his change of heart. Nationwide, attitudes about U.S. drug policy have shifted amongst the American people themselves. And the most profound demonstration of that shift happened in this election. Voters in several states and Washington, D.C. passed laws either legalizing or decriminalizing various drugs. So from NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. And let's put it another way. In November 2020, wherever the war on drugs was on the ballot, the war on drugs lost. So we're going to explore why. And Bo Kilmer joins us. He's director at RAND's Drug Policy Research Center, and he's with us from Santa Monica, California. Bo, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, Meghna. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So how would you characterize the way voters voted regarding drugs in the United States on Election Day?
Well, you know, I've spent more than half of my life researching drug policy. And it used to be the case that if you wanted to learn about noteworthy alternatives to drug prohibition, you'd have to focus on countries outside of the United States. That's no longer the case. Now, November 3rd was a historic night for drug policy. Now, there were dozens of drug-related ballot initiatives considered at the state and local levels. But the eight statewide initiatives, which all passed, you know, received most of the attention, and they can be classified into four general categories. First, we have legalization. So four more states approved commercial supply and legal sales of cannabis to adults, meaning that about 35% of the U.S. population now lives in states that have legalized cannabis. The second
Let's just jump in here to say that's Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, and South Dakota.
Yep. Those were the four that added it.
Okay.
And then, the second category is about medical or therapeutic use. So both South Dakota and Mississippi passed laws allowing medical cannabis, and Oregon actually approved a ballot initiative which legalized the use of psilocybin, which is the psychedelic component of magic mushrooms, in a therapeutic setting. It's not as if you're going to be able to go to a store and buy a bag of shrooms and then just go to a park. I mean, it has to be supervised. Mm-hmm. The third category is decriminalization. So Oregon passed a second initiative which decriminalized the possession of small amounts of all drugs. So now if you get caught with anything ranging from cocaine to fentanyl, it's either a $100 fine or you have to undergo a health assessment. But, you know, as I'm sure we're going to discuss later in the show, the initiative that actually passed in Oregon did much more than decriminalize drug possession. And the final category is deprioritization. So the voters in Washington, D.C., they didn't change the laws about psilocybin or other psychedelic plants. But what they did is they made arrests for these substances among the lowest law enforcement priorities for the Metropolitan Police Department.
So these four sort of categories of actions that voters approved across the country, the broad point being that it all happened at once, and it is quite a sea change. But I think it's important to note that the categories sort of evince very different goals, right? Like legalization for recreational use of marijuana is a very different thing than the decriminalization of small amounts of possession of almost all drugs, including cocaine, heroin, oxycodone. So can you talk about what sort of what's driving the different moves in different states? Because I don't think people actually feel the same way about drugs depending on what set of voters you're talking about.
Well, I do think it's important to make this distinction between legalization and decriminalization. Now, these terms often get used interchangeably, but they're very different. So when we talk about legalizing a substance, we're typically talking about legalizing supply as well as possession for adults. Now, when we talk about decriminalization, we're typically referring to just changing the penalties for possessing small amounts, having it go from being a felony or a misdemeanor to something more like a civil offense or a traffic penalty. And so, as I said, 35% of the U.S. population lives in states that have legalized commercial sales for cannabis. And so that accounts, that's 15 states. Since the 70s, a number of states had already decriminalized the possession of cannabis. But what was really noteworthy about November 3rd is the Oregon Initiative, which decriminalized the possession of all drugs. That's a first in the United States.
Yeah, and we will spend quite a bit of the show really digging into the Oregon example. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit more about Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, South Dakota, the states that are joining this growing group of states that have legalized marijuana for recreational use. Is the big driver there, A, not just sort of a change of heart amongst voters and lawmakers, but the revenue that cash-strapped states can pull in through marijuana sales?
Well, there are a lot of arguments that are made for legalizing cannabis sales. You're hearing a lot more about social equity. Some people just want a better regulated product. But yes, there are some states that are looking at this in terms of generating revenue. And money does come in. So if we do look at some of the early movers. So if you look at Colorado and Washington, and if we look at kind of how much money they brought in from cannabis in 2019, in Colorado, that was about $300 million. In Washington, that was about $400 million. And if you actually do the math, it works out to about $50 per person in each of these states. Now, I caution jurisdictions from just, that are considering this, from just kind of taking their state population and multiplying it by 50. With legalization, you really have to be concerned about price drops. And because we know that when you legalize a substance, you get rid of the risk, you allow for large grows, it kind of pushes down those production and the distribution costs. And we also see this now kind of pushing down the retail prices. And this is important because the way that a lot of states tax cannabis is they tax it as a function of the price. So it's an ad valorem tax. But realize if you have one of these ad valorem taxes and the prices go down, so will your tax revenue, unless you see a big increase in consumption. So I'll be very clear. Nobody knows the best way to tax cannabis. But I think there's a growing consensus that taxing it as a function of price isn't the way to go. And I wouldn't be surprised if you end up hearing more about taxing cannabis as a function of its potency or its THC content. Mm. In fact, that's what Canada does with respect to its edibles and its cannabis concentrates. And even in Illinois, they have a separate tax depending on whether or not the THC content is above 35%. And, you know, where I am here in California, about a year ago, the Legislative Analyst Office produced a report basically telling the legislature that you need to rethink how you tax cannabis. And one of the options you should consider is a potency tax.
Mm-hmm. So big picture here, the federal government still has a very specific view of drug possession and sales in the United States. How at odds is the federal government's stance vis-a-vis the direction that some of these states seem to be moving? And what does that mean?
You're right, Magda. I mean, this is still all illegal under federal law. And in fact, you know, after Colorado and Washington passed legalization in 2012, you know, no one was quite sure what the federal government was going to do. And it wasn't until later in 2013 that the Department of Justice released a memo referred to as the Cole Memo, indicating that look, they weren't going to be legalizing at the federal level. But as long as states followed certain guidelines, they weren't going to intervene. Now, when Trump took over, they ended up repealing or rescinding this memo. But for all for all intents and purposes, it really didn't make much of a difference. And look, there's a lot of different ways that federal legalization could look, and it could dramatically change the economic landscape of cannabis.
Hmm. Well, we're exploring how and why so many voters in a variety of states, Republican and Democrat, red and blue, made affirmative decisions against the war on drugs, whether it's decriminalization or legalization in this election, and what that means for the national attitude about drugs. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are exploring this hour what voters in a variety of states across the country had to say about drugs in this election. Every state in which the war on drugs was on the ballot, if I can put it that way, the war on drugs lost because many states either legalized the use of recreational marijuana or medical marijuana. One state, Oregon, went as far as decriminalizing possession of small amounts of almost every drug. And we're going to explore that in a second here. I'm joined today by Bo Kilmer. He's director of RAND's Drug Policy Research Center and author of The Future of Fentanyl and Other Synthetic Opioids. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about, if you live in one of the states where you voted on drug policy, how did you vote and what did you make of the outcome? Do you think that there's a big shift going on nationally, or are you concerned with the direction things are headed? You can hop over to Twitter or Facebook. We're at On Point Radio and let us know what you think. Now, we've mentioned Oregon several times because by far the most expansive change, as Bo was talking about, did happen in Oregon, where voters passed ballot measure 110. Now, that made Oregon the first state of the nation to decriminalize possession of small amounts of most drugs, including heroin, oxycodone, methamphetamine, and cocaine. Possession there is now a civil offense, subject to a $100 fine and no jail time. Larger amounts of possession, once a felony, are now misdemeanors. And a study by the state's Criminal Justice Commission found Measure 110 could reduce convictions for drug possession by 90%. And in the election this month, Measure 110 passed in Oregon with 58.5 percent of the vote. So joining us now from Portland, Oregon, is Haven Wheelock. She's a syringe exchange coordinator at Outside In, the first syringe exchange program in the country. Haven was also one of the local sponsors of ballot measure 110. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us from New York is Cassandra Frederick, executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, a national nonprofit that's working to end the war on drugs, as they say. They provided a lot of the funding and policy push behind ballot measure 110 in Oregon. Cassandra, welcome to you.
Thanks for having us.
So Haven, first of all, tell me why you decided to be the local petitioner for this and why you thought it was time for a really big sea change in drug policy in the state of Oregon.
So I've been working with folks who are using substances for nearly 20 years, and I have seen the devastating effects that the war on drugs has had on people I care about. Oregon consistently ranks at the very bottom for access to substance use treatment and services. And knowing that we have 40 years of 50 years of this war on drugs failing people I care about, it just seemed like it's time to stop doing exactly what we've been doing and try something new.
Mm. And Cassandra, the Drug Policy Alliance is a national group that's trying to change policy across the country. Why Oregon? Why did you choose that state as a place to push what is now sort of almost a revolutionary policy in drugs in the United States?
Well, you know, I think folks have asked us this question often, why Oregon? And part of the reason why Drug Policy Action built this campaign in Oregon is because we've been working with people like Haven for over 20 years on groundbreaking drug policy reform. And so we already had groups of people on the ground that we had been working with for decades. And we took this moment to have conversations with folks on the ground, parents, healthcare providers, teachers, advocates, people involved in addiction recovery services, to really have a conversation. And one of the things that they said overwhelmingly was like, they don't want to criminalize people and they desperately need better access to treatment and harm reduction services. And, you know, Oregon was not the only state that Drug Policy Action was looking at. But Haven was one of the most fervent advocates to get us to work with her in Oregon and invest and build the field of dreams.
Mm. Well, so I want to, as we explore what ballot measure 110 hopes to accomplish, I want to acknowledge that there was pushback in Oregon to the measure's efforts. So first, for example, here's Washington County District Attorney Kevin Barton. He told Coin 6 News last month that he thinks measure 110 in Oregon is actually an experiment, a big national experiment.
It's a Trojan horse measure where it looks like one thing. It looks like it's focused on rehabilitation and treatment, which sound wonderful. But in reality, what it really does is it's this one of the single largest changes in our criminal justice system in decades by decriminalizing vast amounts of hard drug possession. And it's supported by a group of people who don't live here and don't have skin in the game. If it works out, then that's great. If it doesn't work out, then it's not their problem.
So that's the Washington County DA. Now, about this issue of if the ballot measure actually will achieve the goals that you stated here, we also spoke with Mike Marshall, who's co-founder and director of Oregon Recovers, an advocacy group that pushes for an expansion of drug treatment. And he told us he sees there's a conflict between the goals of groups like yours, Cassandra, and groups like his that are focused on addiction treatment.
One of the reasons we opposed Measure 110 was because it didn't take into consideration the addiction crisis. It was, you know, the Drug Policy Alliance is very focused on ending the war on drugs, which is a legal effort. We're focused on ending the addiction crisis, which needs a healthcare response.
So, Cassandra, I'll let you respond to that first. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I think this is a matter of people having a difference of opinion about how we get to the end goal. Ending the drug war means that we are supporting people that are navigating addiction. We have Drug Policy Alliance and Action has always supported replacing criminalization with health-based approach responses. We have always said that we have to move drug policy from a criminal justice issue to one that is a public health issue. Measure 110 does that. And I think oftentimes what people miss is that what you miss in the conversation when you're hearing from the district attorney and what you're hearing from Mike Marshall is that they believe that criminalization is an appropriate response to get people access to treatment. And that is a fundamental difference. We believe that criminalization should not be the thing that creates the opportunity for people to gain access. That, in fact, we don't need to punish people to give them help. We should just give people help. And that help needs to be affirming and voluntary and not coercive and punishing. I'm a social worker, so I very much understand how people think helping is important. And sometimes they help at the expense of the person. And that's what criminalization does. And so for us, it's really about understanding that we can give people help without punishing people. Mm. And that's crucial to M110.
Well, so Haven, the bill, the ballot measure does call for taking some tax revenue from cannabis sales in Oregon and use that revenue for addiction treatment. But folks like Mike Marshall told us that they don't think that the measure goes far enough to improve treatment options for people who are suffering from drug addiction in Oregon. And in fact, he says it derailed efforts that were already underway in working with the legislature to get more funds and support for treatment options for people in Oregon.
With the idea that this is not going to help our communities, we're so far behind in access to care right now that any investment is good investment. And I am dedicated to, like, this is a first step. We're not done. Measure 110 is not ending the war on drugs, and it's not going to, like, on its own solve the addiction crisis. We still have a lot of work to do, and I'm very excited to be part of doing that work. And to the idea that this is an outside organization coming in to Oregon to do this thing, I have been working on these policies for decades, and I'm very lucky to be able to partner with DPA on this. Cassandra and I go way back, and I really push back on this idea that DPA is pushing this when I've been talking about this for literally decades.
So then tell me in a little bit more detail how much ballot measure 110, you know, is going to help. How much money is proposed is going to help towards advancing treatment options for Oregonians?
So right now, the revenue projections will be around $100 million of investment into services for folks who are using. And that money is to be applied across the state, which will allow for access in places that currently just have no access to services at all.
Bo Kilmer, jump in here and give us your take on what you're hearing, because just in the Oregon example, to the point that Cassandra and Haven are making, it's not either or, right? Like, drug policy isn't simply one thing or another. So what are we seeing in the debate that happened in Oregon, even with the acknowledgement that almost 60% of voters did vote to approve Measure 110?
I think it's important to acknowledge that what passed in Oregon was much more than just decriminalizing possession. You know, it sets up, you know, the initiative will set up nearly a dozen addiction recovery centers across the state where they'll be able to conduct health assessments and potentially make referrals to treatment and other services. And as Haven mentioned, it sets aside funds for these recovery centers, as well as, potentially providing, funding for substance use disorder treatment, permanent supportive housing, other services. And it also actually reduces the penalties for those that get caught with larger amounts. Now, you know, I want to make it clear RAND doesn't take positions on bills or initiatives. But, you know, as I was paying close attention to what was happening there, and I think there was a lot of debate about, what the overall impact is going to be on drug treatment admissions in Oregon. You know, because on one hand, with decriminalization, it could reduce some of those criminal justice referrals to treatment. But on the other, it could increase referrals to treatment through these health assessments. And also, if this policy is able to kind of reduce the stigma associated with using drugs, it could lead to more people asking for help, potentially acknowledging that they have problems. So a lot's going to also depend on what happens to the treatment capacity in the state. So from a research perspective, I'm going to be paying really close attention to not only what happens in terms of treatment admissions, but also the types of treatment. You know, we want to make sure that people, that they're not only getting treatment if they need it, but they're getting high quality treatment. And the final point I want to make, though, is, but when we think about health of people who use drugs more generally, it's not just about drug treatment services. You know, if these referrals help get more people the services they need, it could improve other health outcomes as well. For example, those who may have infectious diseases, those who have other mental health disorders. But a lot's going to depend on how all of this money gets distributed. And so the measure requires the Oregon Health Authority to create this Oversight and Accountability Council. And they're the ones that are going to be making the decisions about how much money actually goes to treatment, how much goes to the health assessment centers. And the decisions they make are really going to determine how this all plays out.
Mm. Now, to your point about that typically people suffering from addiction challenges sometimes could get referrals through the criminal justice system for treatment. Now, on that point, Mike Marshall, again, co-founder of Oregon Recovers, a group that opposed Measure 110 and pushing for expanded drug treatment access. Marshall told us that he worries that the measure will derail the current structure for how people can get treatment in the state.
We need to protect the pathway to recovery that already existed for folks. So there's two parts of that. It used to be that if I was downtown and arrested for possession, I would then be sent to court. The judge could then send me to treatment, and he had funds to pay for it. Again, whether adult or child, that pathway has been cut away. That's gone. And so now you can call an 800 number and talk to someone who can help you, but you don't get access to treatment. So we need to figure out if a parent or even an adult wants to go to treatment, who's going to fund that? Before, the courts would fund it. Now that's been taken away from them.
Now, Marshall also said that he is concerned about the claims of how much incarceration will go down or could go down now that Measure 110 has passed. And here's what he said.
Do I think fewer people ultimately are going to be incarcerated? No, we don't incarcerate anyone in Oregon right now unless they leave treatment early and the judge wants to throw them in jail for a night to get them to go back to treatment. But we can't afford to incarcerate people. And will it keep some folks from having a criminal record that will hurt them later in life? Without a doubt. But if your choice is the coroner or the criminal justice system, I think most people would pick the criminal justice system.
Cassandra, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, that is just a devastating statement based in ignorance. Honestly, like, we should have conversations about how many people die from the criminal justice system. What we're talking about, so many people flooded the streets this summer talking about how we didn't want law enforcement engagement. We're talking about how George Floyd was killed in the street on camera. Most people don't realize that his first engagement with the criminal justice system was through a drug possession arrest. And he struggled with addiction and treatment and coercion throughout his life, which was written in the Washington Post. We're talking about Rashard Brooks, who was intoxicated in the Wendy's parking lot, and he wanted to walk home and didn't want to engage with law enforcement, and then was killed. And we all saw that. We're talking about Breonna Taylor, who was sleeping in her bed where she was killed because they wanted to arrest someone. I think it is a problem when we don't fully take into consideration how criminalization is dangerous. It is bad for our health and it kills people. And I think it's really, really important to remember what we're saying. This person also said that because, you know, Mike Marshall talked about his own use earlier in the fight and talked about how you know, it was a privilege that he didn't get arrested. And I think about all the people that Haven works with who don't have those privileges that are being harmed by the criminal justice system. And to be very clear, the racial disparities in arrest in Oregon are astronomical. And an independent study showed that it would decline the conviction racial disparities by 95%. Black and indigenous Oregonians the racial disparities would decline. And I think it is a stunning statement based in privilege.
So Cassandra and Bo Kilmer, hang on here. Haven Wheelock in Portland, Oregon, I've got to let you go, but thank you so much for joining us today, Haven.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we are talking this hour about the wave of ballot measures and questions that voters had before them in various states across the country regarding drug policy, and how voters really pushed back against decades of extant policy on the war on drugs. We're going to zoom back out to the national level when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about the journey that a potential vaccine for COVID-19 will need to take from approval to public distribution to the jab in your arm. There are multiple vaccine trials that have yielded promising early results, very promising early results. So what questions do you have about what comes next? What do you want to know about those vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna that are being developed? Share your questions at 617-353-0683, because we're going to talk to some vaccine experts tomorrow. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we are taking a look at the raft of ballot measures that were put in front of voters in several states in this election about drug policy, whether it's legalization of recreational marijuana or, for example, in Oregon, decriminalization of almost all drugs, possession of all drugs underneath a certain amount. I'm joined today by Bo Kilmer. He's director of RAND's Drug Policy Research Center, and by Cassandra Frederick, executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, a national nonprofit that says it's working to end the war on drugs, and they were a major force behind Oregon's ballot measure 110. Now, Bo and Cassandra, if you could just hang in here with me for a little bit. We want to zoom out not just to the national level, but the international level. Because, Bo, you had said earlier that if you really wanted to see examples of decriminalization, large-scale examples, until very recently, you had to look abroad. Well, in fact, that's exactly what we did, because we looked at the example of Portugal.
We were leaving devastating condition, mostly related to heroin use in those days. But it's important to tell you a little bit the story of it.
Well, that's Dr. João Goulao. He's Portugal's national drug coordinator. And he told us that the story of Portugal's decriminalization efforts began with political change in the 1970s.
Suddenly, we had our democratic revolution in 1974. A lot of changes in our society, a sudden openness to the world. a sudden change in society behaviors, openness to some ideas, even divorcing was difficult before the revolution. So there was a huge number of changes.
Goulao says a new government, the return of soldiers from ex-Portuguese colonies, and that newfound sense of freedom became intricately tied with drug experimentation.
So suddenly we had everything, plenty of cannabis, but heroin, cocaine, LSD, you name it. Everything was made available in a very short time after that. In a completely naive society towards drugs, we knew nothing.
Now, Goulao also told us that drug abuse and addiction steadily worsened over the next 20 years. And by 1998, that led Portugal to change tack on its drug control efforts. So what drove that change? Well, the reason he gave us sounded pretty familiar.
If you have medium class, upper class people dying and suffering from the opioid epidemic, it's easier to pass the idea, okay, this is a disease. Those people need health care, social care, instead of going into jail. And that makes all the difference. And I think that we took that opportunity here when we had 1% of our population, 100,000 people hooked on heroin all over society, you know. We took that opportunity to launch a reflection about the legal framework for drugs.
That reflection took place in Portugal in the late 90s, and Dr. Goulao was a member of the committee that crafted Portugal's drug decriminalization policy. The national legislature passed it in 2001. And Goulao says the opioid epidemic in the United States presents a similar opportunity for reflection in this country. And he told us that in Portugal, the new policy has had a major effect. Goulao says petty crime in Portugal has gone down by 50%, and there's been a similar reduction in other drug-related problems.
HIV infections have dropped dramatically. Overdoses deaths. Before the decriminalization, we had at least one overdose dead a day. That means 365 a year. Nowadays, we have 30, 40 a year.
However, Dr. Goulao does add a very strong word of caution. He told us that decriminalization is not a solution in and of itself, that decriminalization without health and economic support simply won't be effective.
Decriminalization is not the magic, it's not the silver bullet, okay? You need to do much more than that. You need to offer to the people who use drugs in a problematic way the health responses that they need. Just decriminalizing by itself does not lead us anywhere.
That's Dr. João Goulao. He's Portugal's national drug coordinator, and he spoke to us from Lisbon. Bo Kilmer, Dr. Goulao emphasized to us that the use and possession of drugs in Portugal is still illegal. It's simply been decriminalized. What lessons do you take from the Portuguese example that might apply here in the United States?
Well, similar to what passed in Oregon, the reforms that happened in Portugal in the early 2000s were much more than just decriminalizing possession of all drugs. You know, there also was a really large increase in spending on treatment, a large increase in spending on outreach services. And what the reforms did is they also created what they were called dissuasion committees. So essentially, if you got caught with a small amount of drugs, instead of being taken to a police station, you would then go in front of a commission. And, you know, it'd be a meeting with maybe three people, someone, you know, a medical official, maybe someone from social services, and they would talk to you about your drug use and what your service needs were. And then based on that, they would make recommendations. So now most of the the cases at these dissuasion commissions are for cannabis. And, you know, a lot of those are suspended. But about 15% of them involve a referral to treatment. And then about 14-15% involve what you might call a punitive ruling, where there may be a fine, an obligation to attend a drug education class, or you may even lose a professional or a firearms license. Now, in terms of what happened after the Portuguese reforms, you know, definitely the number of people in treatment increased throughout the country. HIV rates and drug-induced deaths declined. That said, you know, as João mentioned, you know, right before the policy passed, they were at a peak in terms of HIV transmission via injection drug use. So it's really hard to figure out how much of that decline that happened afterwards was because of the policy versus other other explanations. And we know the demand for heroin at that time was falling elsewhere in Europe. But the research suggests that, look, after they passed this, passed these reforms, there may have been an increase in experimentation with some of these drugs, but it didn't necessarily last. And when they compared, so this is Caitlin Hughes and Alex Stevens, two researchers who spent a lot of time kind of focusing on Portugal. When they compared Portugal to Italy and Spain and kind of looking at the number of what you would, might call what they defined as problematic drug users, they found, if anything, there was a decline in Portugal after the reforms passed, suggesting that it definitely didn't lead to this large increase in, you know, quote unquote, problematic drug use. And I think the other thing to kind of keep in mind is, you know, this all happened about 20 years ago. Now, there have been multiple governments in Portugal since then. And, you know, this just isn't an issue. It's not controversial. And as I said, it was used to be the case that everyone had to look to Portugal. And I mean, there have been some other countries that have decriminalized possession. But now I think there's going to be a lot more focus on Oregon.
Hmm. Cassandra, do you want to give us your thoughts on the Portugal example?
I think the Portugal example is a great learning for the rest of the country that other people have done this, and that it's going to take multiple different models for us to figure out how to move forward. But what it really shows is that we can do this. Like there are other people that understand and affirm that this is a health issue and that we should give people more access to different kinds of options as opposed to trying to funnel them through the criminal legal system. And, you know, multiple people have studied Portugal for a very long time. And there are other countries that have done similar kinds of things or have different policies. But most people, when we're talking internationally, understand that decriminalization is a key strategy in not only in freeing up resources in order to give people the things that they need to live healthy lives.
Yeah. So,
and if I can, if I could just add to that, I mean, you've got the World Health Organization, the Organization of American States, and other international groups have all come out supporting decriminalizing the possession of drugs. And so while this is a big deal that this happened in Oregon, you go outside of the United States, this is less controversial.
I see. So I want to ask both of you about how we read what the national mood is on laws around and consequences around drug use and drug possession. Because, for example, for marijuana specifically, I'm looking at some data here from Gallup that shows that the percentage of Americans that thought that marijuana should be made legal in 1971 was roughly 12%. By the time you get to 2019, it's up at 66%, so two-thirds of Americans. So a really big change there. Bo, do we see a commensurate change in the appetite for legalization of other kinds of drugs, or does marijuana sort of stand alone in its increased acceptance?
Cannabis stands alone. I mean, I haven't looked at the polls on legalizing cocaine, but, you know, back in the day, it was maybe 5-10% support. I mean, that may be going up a little bit, but in terms of kind of the appetite for the public, I mean, there definitely has been more support for, you know, legalizing the sales of cannabis. And I do think that you're going to see more states, you know, considering ballot initiatives to decriminalize all drugs. But, Yeah, as you mentioned, 12% in the 70s. And then even if you look at medical cannabis, I mean, this, depending on the poll, I mean, the support for that is in the high 80s, you know, low 90s. And so I do think this is going to put more pressure on the federal government, not only the public support, but kind of what's happening. Now, at the top of the hour, I had mentioned that now you've got 35% of the U.S. population lives in states that have legalized commercial supply and retail sales to adults. But realize one of the states that passed on November 3rd was New Jersey. And in both New York and in Pennsylvania, they've been having very serious conversations about legalization for a few years. And I suspect that now that their neighbor New Jersey is on track to start sales, I think that's going to intensify discussions in those two states. And if those two states legalize, we then would have 45% of the U.S. population living in legalization states. And so it's as I mentioned earlier, federal legalization could look a lot of different ways, but I expect the federal conversations are also going to intensify over the next few years.
Yeah. Cassandra, I imagine that some people are worried about what impact decriminalization or expanded legalization, again, two different things, would have on maybe they're concerned about it exacerbating the violence that's associated with the drug trade across U.S. borders, or even the violence that can be associated with it inside the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, because there's the trade of these substances is still illegal, even in Oregon. So your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say that we're having a conversation and struggling around drug prohibition. Drug prohibition creates the conditions for violence associated with these markets, and that what we are prioritizing right now is figuring out how can we support people. But there's a larger conversation we need to have as a nation around why drug prohibition is not an effective intervention to dealing with the health consequences associated with drugs, but or the violence associated with drug markets. And so it's really I think what we're seeing, not just internationally, but within the country, it's not just drugs that are leading to these to the violence. It's economic policies. It's trade policies. Drugs are playing a scapegoat role in larger, broader societal issues. And I think it's really important for us to understand that this has to be a part of a comprehensive conversation about the societies we want to live in. And I want to just offer to the question that you offered, Bo, I think the right question is what is clear is that voters and Americans in general recognize that criminalizing people for drugs is not something they want to invest their money into, and that we need to be figuring out different models for us to move away from law enforcement as the main intervening agency in the way that we deal with drug use and drug possession in this country. And I think that's, if you do that poll, I think it's going to be really, really strong, because there were people in the streets all summer telling us that we want to divest from law enforcement and invest in the health and wellness of communities around the country.
And yet there's so much more to discuss, because there's also still that big gap between what's bubbling up from the states and what's happening at the federal level. Even the president-elect right now, President-elect Joe Biden, is still opposed to full legalization of marijuana and argues for milder things like decriminalization at the federal level. But we will continue to explore this absolutely fascinating issue. So for now, let me tell Cassandra Frederick, Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
And Bo Kilmer, director at RAND's Drug Policy Research Center and author of The Future of Fentanyl and Other Synthetic Opioids. Bo, thank you.
Thanks for the great conversation.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.